on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us?
Hello, today is Monday, September 17th. I'm Morgan Yee.
And I'm Claire Eagle. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:06 p.m. and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. We also have our science segment, Simply Science, with Sarah Chow, and our health segment brought to you by Dietetic Intuition.
All this plus your weekday weather forecast brought to you by the UBC Storm Club, right here on News 101, your source for independent news.
The Faculty of Law here at UBC is the first Canadian law program to make the study of Aboriginal legal issues mandatory. Beginning with the class of 2015, first-year students will study the new and improved Law 100 course, Canadian Constitutional Law, which places greater emphasis on Section 35 of the Canadian Constitution, dealing with Aboriginal rights. This change is partially due to the National Federation of Law Societies, which changed its core competencies guidelines, but also because much of the faculty believes it is essential to have a greater understanding of Aboriginal issues, especially in BC. Darlene Johnston, a professor at UBC who specialized in Aboriginal and treaty law, said, quote, "I don't think you can practice law in British Columbia without encountering Aboriginal legal issues," end quote. This same concern was mirrored by students in the law program. One student said in an interview with the UBC, quote, "It's been very contentious. I was on the Academic Issues Committee last year when these changes were being debated. I can tell you there was a contingent of people who felt very strongly that if Aboriginal rights wasn't being covered, that Aboriginal rights weren't being covered enough by some professors," end quote. The changes currently in effect have been generally well received by first-year law students, and the faculty hopes the positive benefits of the emphasis will show or will allow their students to flourish in the world of British Columbian law. UBC is offering a one-year program in horticulture starting this September. There are currently 15 students enrolled in the program. Students not only learn the science behind horticulture, but also take part in the physical labor required to grow plants. Run through UBC Botanical Garden, completion of the $5,500 program entitles students to enter Level 2 of the BC Provincial Horticulture Apprenticeship Program.
Last week, the University of British Columbia officially opened a pioneering $34 million clean energy facility, making it Canada's first university and one of a few institutions worldwide to produce both clean heat and electricity for its campus from renewable bioenergy. UBC's Bioenergy Research and Demonstration Facility, or the BRDF, will generate enough clean electricity to power 1,500 homes and will supply up to 12% of UBC's heat requirements. The facility runs on tree trimmings and wood chips diverted from local landfills, and it will reduce UBC's natural gas consumption by 12% and campus greenhouse gas emissions by 9%, or 5,000 tons, which is the equivalent of taking 1,000 cars off the road. The electricity produced by the Bioenergy Research and Demonstration Facility will feed into UBC's power grid, which will result in revenue to UBC through what is called a quote-unquote displaced load agreement with BC Hydro. UBC is the largest public sector single-site emitter of greenhouse gases in BC and BC Hydro's second-largest customer. In a statement, Professor Stephen Toop, the President and Vice Chancellor of UBC, said, quote, "This project demonstrates UBC's leadership in sustainability and our concept of the campus as a living laboratory. This groundbreaking partnership is helping UBC achieve its sustainability goals through the convergence of research, operations, and industry in the bioenergy sphere."
The Faculty of Dentistry at the University of British Columbia has received an in-kind gift of $8 million from the Ho Chi Minh City National Hospital of Odontostomatology to create an oral health research center. Oral health is a major concern in Vietnam as 80% of children suffer severe tooth decay and oral cancer is often fatal. The new UBC Dentistry Vietnam Oral Health Research Center will try to address these issues by focusing on research areas that include oral cancer and craniofacial birth defects. It will be housed on the fourth floor of the National Hospital of Odontostomatology. Dr. Lam Hoi Phong, Director of Vietnam's National Hospital of Odontostomatology, says, quote, "Our hospital is proud of cooperating with UBC. It is a valuable opportunity to exchange knowledge between visiting dentistry residents, UBC faculty, Vietnamese scholars, dental students, and general dentists," end quote. This gift is the Faculty of Dentistry's largest to date.
TransLink has announced that the company has found an average of $98 million a year in new efficiencies, which can be put towards projects such as rapid transit bus across the Portman Bridge, upgrades to SkyTrain stations, and extended B-line bus routes. Also included in the list of projects is the Evergreen Line, at an estimated cost of $1.4 billion and 109,000 new hours of public transit service. Just where these efficiencies are coming from is not yet clear, but as the draft plan goes before the public and committee, it is expected that these details will be outlined further.
A group of East Vancouver seniors fears they have lost their voice after a part-time programmer position was axed last week. In a meeting held by the seniors in an attempt to get the position reinstated, members of the Trout Lake Community Center expressed their frustration at the loss of the resource. Jen Wright, the program coordinator in question, was also in attendance, and after 11 years of service, she said, quote, "I'm disappointed. I worked really hard to make sure our seniors were engaged and involved," end quote. Seniors activist Lorna Gibbs, the president of South Vancouver Seniors Arts and Cultural Society, said, quote, "You can say the seniors from the Fraser River to East Hastings have definitely been overlooked," end quote. The seniors hope that their voice will continue to be heard at the community center and have been assured by Joyce Courtney, the Parks Board media spokesperson, that, quote, "activities for older adults continue to be a very important part of the community recreation programs at Trout Lake," end quote.
And these are exciting times for environmentalists living in the region of East Kootenay and across Canada. In 2010, following years of protests and international campaigning by North American environmentalists and a recommended moratorium by a team of UN scientists, the BC Liberals government passed legislation which banned all forms of mining, oil and gas development, and coal bed gas extraction in Flathead Valley, BC. Situated in the southeast corner of the province, Flathead Valley is called the so-called Serengeti of the North because it is home to an abundance of wildlife native to North America, including bighorn sheep, moose, wolverines, elk, and grizzly bears. However, some uncertainty still clouded the issue as the very same legislature included a provision that environmentalists would have to help generate the money to buy out mining claims already laid in an area causing concern from the community. Well, now, 2 years later, the case is finally going to be closed. John Lowndes, the CEO of the Nature Conservancy of Canada, announced his organization has successfully raised over $10 million to protect the Flathead, along with their U.S. counterpart, the Nature Conservancy. Half of the money came from federal funding, while a further $2.5 million came from the international private equity firm Warburg Pincus. Environment leader, executive director of WildSight, John Bergensk, applauds his closure to this series of events, saying, quote, "Everyone who cares about wildlife, fish, water, and a healthy ecosystem, they have to applaud the government's actions," end quote. He also added that while the ban on energy and mine development is a great first step, the job is far from complete. Pressing onward, next on his organization's agenda is to get the area approved as a national park. To track their progress and learn more about endeavors to continue protecting the Flat Valley, visit the website at www.flathead.ca.
Recently in the news, it was announced that Vancouver's own newspaper, the West Coast Reader, intended to get the news to lower-level readers, would be getting government funding to increase the availability of the paper. The West Coast Reader, a monthly paper which takes articles from other local publications and condenses the articles to approximately 100 words, has been influential in many English as a Second Language courses held in the city and serves 300 communities across BC with a readership of over 125,000. The new funds provided by the Ministry of Jobs, Tourism, and Innovation will hopefully allow the publication to extend its reach. Surveys have revealed that English as a second language literacy and multicultural seniors groups, Aboriginal learners, elementary and secondary school students, prison inmates, and people who have had strokes and brain injuries read this paper.
On Saturday, 10 years after the Woodward's building was occupied by squatters, hundreds of protesters took to the streets of the downtown east side here in Vancouver. 350 people, led by a group of First Nations elders, waved signs in the heart of the neighborhood demanding action for the homeless. The neighborhood is currently in transition, and homelessness continues to be a major preoccupation for civic leaders. But protesters say there has been little improvement since the famous occupation of Woodward's building 10 years ago. Said one protester, quote, "This is my neighborhood. Gentrification is not good. There is no housing for women who need it. There's too much violence against women and the poor here," end quote. Others say the protest was a way to express their frustration at the lack of affordable housing in general in Vancouver.
And those are your UBC campus and local headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned for local weather forecasts as well as your provincial and national headlines.
Shindig is back. CITR's annual Battle of the Bands spans 13 weeks and 27 bands. Past participants of Shindig include the Pack AD, 3 Inches of Blood, Japan Droids, Yusei Party, and so much more. The second night of Shindig takes place September 18th at the Railway Club, starting at 9 p.m., featuring Nomadics, Sean Stibbards, and Teapot Hill. For all the details, search CITR Shindig on Facebook or go to citr.ca.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver or online at citr.ca. I'm Claire Eagle, and it is now time for your weekday weather forecast with our very own Phil Chang. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Claire. Thank you for having me. Pretty straightforward week is coming up. Sunshine all week, thanks to a high-pressure cell sustaining over the Pacific Ocean for an entirety of 5 days, believe it or not.
Awesome.
Some high-altitude scattered clouds will be visible throughout the week, and at times it will be completely clear. A light breeze is expected to blow daily, averaging about 5 kilometers per hour, so all in all, a very pleasant week coming up. And now here is Environment Canada's Vancouver forecast for this coming week. Tonight, clear, low of 12. Tuesday, sunny with fog patches dissipating in the morning. High of 22, 28 inland. UV index of 5 or moderate. Tuesday night, clear, low of 13. Wednesday, sunny, high of 22, 27 inland. Thursday, also sunny, low of 13, high of 22, 27 inland. And Friday, sunny, low of 13, high of 20, 25 inland. So yeah, that's your very sunny weekday weather forecast. Reporting for News 101, I'm Phil Chang from the UBC Storm Club.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Phil, for that weather forecast. It sounds like it's going to be pretty awesome. I'm definitely looking forward to getting some of that sun. So it is now time for your provincial and national headlines.
British Columbians could be in for turbulent times this fall as several labor unions in the public sector threaten to disrupt daily living, from stopping the bus to work to blocking car insurance claims to cramping university students' campus routines. Over the coming week, several unions have indicated they'll forge ahead in their aims of reaching difficult deals. The BC Government Employees Union is stepping up ongoing job action by instituting an overtime ban on Monday for the province's 25,000 public servants. The measure follows a union maneuver earlier this month when workers conducted their first full-scale walkout in more than two decades, albeit only for one day. On Tuesday, more than 1,500 staff with the Insurance Corporation of BC are poised to go on strike from 55 different locations across the province. Many of these workers did not join co-workers who partook in the BCGEU one-day September 5th strike. Also on Tuesday, support staff at the University of Victoria will resume bargaining after shutting down several campus buildings last week with walkouts. But they're expected to continue picketing until talks are restarted in order to keep the pressure up. Next week, another 1,200 workers at Simon Fraser University's three campuses will also hold a strike vote. If the mandate is clear, members will be permitted to serve 72-hour strike notice and be in position for a legal campus-wide walkout.
A northern BC sawmill, which was destroyed in an explosion earlier this year, will be rebuilt using the newest in safety technologies, even in the face of low timber supply. The owner of the mill, Hampton Affiliates, says that negotiations are underway with both the province and local First Nations groups in the region to guarantee 20 years of lumber supply. Steve Zika, CEO of the Hampton Affiliates, said, quote, "We've heard a lot about these assurances, and it's been very recent. They all sound good. We just need to see these agreements and get them in place," end quote. Hampton Affiliates wants all negotiations for the new Bay Bean Forest products concluded this fall. A final decision will be made at a board meeting on December 3rd. Building could begin as early as this winter if weather permits. The mill would be about two-thirds the size of the original and employ approximately half to two-thirds of the 225 workers who were previously employed. BC Jobs Minister Pat Bell commended the family that runs Hampton Affiliates on its decisions, noting the Oregon-based company has assets in the U.S. but chose to reinvest in the province. Bell said, quote, "This is a substantial investment. It is taking a tremendous amount of risk. That is, I think, an enormous vote of confidence in our forest industry," end quote. Workers worry, however, whether or not the safety measures taken this time around will be enough. 2 months before the explosion, the sawmill was found to have dust levels that were twice the acceptable levels, and in April of 2012, an explosion ripped through a second northern BC sawmill, killing two more workers. These disasters prompted WorkSafe BC to order all of BC's mills, numbering in the 300s, to immediately make changes to hazardous dust accumulation, which has been fingered as a possible ignition source.
If any of our listeners have purchased beef in the last 2 weeks, please listen up. The Canadian Food Inspection Agency has ordered a recall of ground beef products sold across Canada at Costco, Walmart, Safeway, and Calahoo meat stores because it may be contaminated with E. coli bacteria. The products from Alberta distributor XL Foods should, quote, "return the products to their point of sale and inquire whether that product is part of the recall," end quote. The recalled products include ground beef, burger patties, ground chuck, ground sirloin patties, stuffed peppers, meatballs, beef sliders, meatloaf, cheddar cheese patties, and ground beef tubes. These products were packaged between August 29th and September 15th, but could have best before dates from September 9th to the 23rd. The CFIA says so far there have been no reports of illness from these products, but also recommends consumers go to their website at inspection.gc.ca for a full list of suspect products.
The president of the Canadian Auto Workers Union said on Monday a deal with Ford Motor Co. appeared imminent, a move that would avert a labor stoppage at the automaker's Canadian plants before a midnight strike deadline. CAW President Ken Lewenza said, quote, "Talks are going very well, very constructive, very positive. It's very clear that they want to get an agreement. It's very clear that the differences over the last 24 hours have been narrowed, and it's very, very clear if we can dot the I's and cross the T's, we will have a tentative agreement at Ford Motor Company within hours, if not minutes," end quote. The union was also in negotiations with the other two Detroit car companies, Fiat SPAs, Chrysler Group LLC, and General Motors, but was focusing on making headway with Ford, the lead company for contract talks.
Environmentalists are organizing what they're calling the largest act of peaceful civil disobedience in Canada to protest the proposed Northern Gateway oil pipeline from Alberta to the BC coast. Greenpeace Canada says a mass sit-in planned for the front lawn of the BC legislature in Victoria on October 22nd is backed by more than 80 leaders from the business, First Nations, environmental, labor, and academic communities across Canada. The group says those supporters include environmentalist David Suzuki, former Canadian UN Ambassador Stephen Lewis, Council of Canadians Chair Maude Barlow, lawyer Clayton Ruby, author Naomi Klein, and economist Mark Jacquard.
Italy announced on Monday that it will protect Canadian interests in Iran following Ottawa's recent severing of diplomatic relations with Tehran. Foreign Minister Giulio Terzi said Canada has made the request after the September 7th closure of the Canadian embassy in the Iranian capital. Canada branded the Islamic Republic as the most significant threat to world peace when it made the move, including ordering Iranian diplomats to leave. International tensions are running high over suspicions that Tehran is rushing to develop nuclear weapons. Iran, however, insists its nuclear activities are aimed at peaceful purposes like power generation and medical treatment. The Italian Foreign Ministry said, quote, "It is a decision taken on the basis of the traditional existing relations with an important friendly and allied country," end quote. Canadian Foreign Minister John Baird said, quote, "Canada conveys its deepest gratitude to the government of Italy for agreeing to provide this valuable assistance," end quote. Mr. Baird said his government began assessing its presence in Iran several months ago, especially after Iranian authorities did nothing to stop an incursion against the British embassy in November. Iran called Canada's embassy closure, quote, "hasty and unwise," end quote, and its parliamentary speaker canceled a visit to Canada in protest. Switzerland represents the U.S. interests in Iran. Canada's break with Tehran took away another channel for Washington to get first-hand diplomatic assessments of Iranian affairs.
And those are your provincial and national headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned for our weekly health segment.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Morgan Yee with Claire Eagle, and you are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, or online at citr.ca. Thank you for being with us.
It is now time for our weekly health segment, Dietetics Intuition. So here we go with that.
Welcome to your weekly health beat on CITR 101.9 FM.
It's Dietetic Intuition, your source for precise nutrition advice.
What are you going to hear? We'll bust nutrition myths, give tips, do book reviews, as well as interviews, you name it. And now here are your dietetic students, Andrea, Jessica, and Sharon, for this week's segment.
Hi everyone, this is Andrea speaking. Thanks so much for joining us on this Monday afternoon. Today we're making this segment really practical and full of quick and easy lunch ideas to ease back into the business of being back to school. Ethnic variety is the theme for today's segment, and this will serve as a reminder to all the great food out there available in the marketplace and may also help keep your lunches interesting so you don't eat out as often. So talking about protein and what other things you can eat if you're tired of eating the same old chicken salad sandwich. Soybean and salads over chickpeas is a great idea if you're looking to add more protein and you're a vegetarian. Grilled tofu instead of hard egg. We have a great recipe which will be on the blog for gado gado, and Malaysian/Singaporean salad which combines both things, and that is delicious. Tandoori chicken over a regular salad with a little drizzle of olive oil because the meat will be seasoned enough is another alternative. And soups. Instead of a normal soup and crackers for lunch, make a batch of lentil soup or dal and make pappardum on the side for your cracker.
Alrighty, so for the grain portion of your lunch, try a roti instead of white bread or other processed white breads like white wraps, or try whole wheat teff wraps. Teff is a grain from Ethiopia, and you can get whole wheat teff wraps at IGA, for example. Kamut and spelt grain instead of white rice, and try some red quinoa, how about? We all have seen regular quinoa, but red quinoa is pretty cool to use in a salad, for example. Try whole wheat couscous instead of regular couscous, or instead of white rice for salads. So moving on to the dairy portion of your lunch, try kefir instead of yogurt at breakfast. Dahi with grilled vegetables or raw instead of ranch dressing or tzatziki. But tzatziki is pretty tasty, so. For fruits and vegetables, guava, try that instead of apple. It gives a nice crunch. Jicama also gives a nice crunch with dressings, like having it in the form of a chip. Or you can even incorporate it into a salad. And for noodles and soup dishes, add one or two bunches of bok choy for crunch and nutrients. For a neat twist on a dessert, try plantain chips fried with a little bit of cinnamon. So these are just a few trade-offs you can do to spice things up and keep the variety in your diet. With a great variety of foods in your diet, you are more likely to meet your recommendations and have fun while eating and sharing with others. So the recipes for the ancient grain salad using kamut and spelt will be on the website. And just to let you know, we got this great recipe from one of our instructors in dietetics, Jerry Kasten, so thank you for that. And then the gado-gado recipe, which is a Malaysian-Singaporean salad, will be on there for roti, dahi, and the plantains as well. So a cool website to check out when I was looking up some stuff for this segment is ethnic-food.info, and it lists ethnic regions out and has a list of recipes in each category. So also on the Dietitians of Canada website, there's a neat spice and herb food pairing chart which may help spice things up in your kitchen. All Recipes is also a great website if you're looking for a bit more variety in your recipes. So enjoy and have a good time cooking and eating. Thanks for tuning in again this week.
If you missed us, please go to blogs.ubc.ca/dietetics-intuition or follow us on Twitter at CITR Health, and even like us on Facebook at Dietetics Intuition. Until next time, stay happy and healthy, Vancouver.
And thank you, girls, for that. It's now time for our international headlines. CJ says not that.
It is actually time for Simply Science by Sarah Chow.
How could we forget?
Of course.
This is Simply Science, bringing you your science news. I'm Sarah Chow. Hello, and welcome back, students, to a brand new school year, full of studying. Well, more like sleepless nights full of cramming. But that's not necessarily a good thing if you want to get good grades. According to researchers at UCLA, sacrificing sleep for extra study time is counterproductive. But wait, doesn't extra study time equal to getting good grades? Well, not according to this study. For 14 days, researchers asked 535 high school students to report on how long they studied, slept, and whether they understood what was taught in class the next day, or how they did on their test or quiz. They found that those who slept more hours per night than their peers had higher grades and did better on tests, which explains why I got 2 out of 30 on my chemistry midterm in first year. Anyway, lack of sleep is associated with greater fatigue the next day, which makes learning difficult. This is because sleep deprivation decreases activity in the hippocampus, a zone in the brain linked to memory processing. Skipping out on sleep can also raise stress hormone levels in the brain, disturbing nerve activity that is associated with memory problems. Now, I'm not saying studying less and sleeping more will give you good grades. What I'm saying is spread out your studying across days instead of cramming, because sleeping shorter hours not only gets you poor grades, it can also mess up your body's natural rhythm and increase your waistline. Our bodies follow a natural rhythm called a circadian rhythm that follows a 24-hour cycle, which coincidentally follows the rotation of the Earth. But as our lives get busier and busier and we push our bodies to the limit by sleeping less, eating meals at irregular times of the day, and exposing ourselves to artificial light so we can work at all hours of the day can mess up our internal synchronization, leading to something called circadian desynchrony. This disrupts systems in the brain that regulate metabolism. When the body's metabolism goes out of sync, and studies have shown, this leads to obesity and diabetes. So to avoid your body going out of whack, especially if you're a student, make sure you eat regularly, get plenty of sleep, and get out and exercise. because you do want to avoid the freshman 15.
For the life of me, I cannot remember what made me think that curly fries wouldn't go straight to my thighs. For the life of me, I cannot believe we multiplied all our chins. We got fat as freshmen.
Oh, yes. The freshman 15, where freshmen gain weight in their first year of school as they adjust to their new university life. Now, putting on a little weight may not seem such a big deal, but it has some pretty big consequences. Gaining as little as 1.5 pounds per year is enough to raise blood pressure by 3 to 5 points, which increases one's risk of heart disease. Over 1 year, researchers at the University of Illinois measured changes in body weight and body mass index in 795 university applicants who were between the ages of 18 to 20 years old. They found 25% of applicants who gained 5% or more weight had higher blood pressure than those who didn't. And this change was more significant in women than men. But don't worry, this effect is reversible. Women who lost 5 pounds or more were able to decrease their blood pressure as well as decrease their risk of heart disease. So what have we learned so far in this week's edition of Simply Science? Well, cramming extra study time instead of sleeping will not give you better grades. Maintaining a regular eat, sleep, exercise routine will keep you away from heart disease, obesity, and the freshman 15. That's it for this week for Simply Science for CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, British Columbia. I'm Sarah Chow.
Thank you to Sarah for her Simply Science segment. You can catch that every Monday here on News 101.
And online at citr.ca/news.
Anytime. So now it is time for International Headlines, brought to you by Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in Headlines. The United States and China traded economic fire today as each lodged complaints against the other at the World Trade Organization. China says a U.S. tariff on imported goods like wind towers, paper, and steel is unfair. The U.S. says the tax is levied because the products are being sold at less than fair market value. This, the White House claims, undercuts U.S. markets. The complaint from China came as the U.S. was also filing a WTO charge over auto and auto parts prices, saying that the artificially low prices China is charging in that market are partially responsible for the loss of jobs in the U.S. auto industry. Turkey's prime minister today claimed that 500 Kurdish rebels have been, quote, rendered ineffective, a euphemism for killed or captured, in the past month. His comments come as the 28-year-old conflict between Kurdish militants and the Turkish military continues to escalate, with heavy casualties on both sides. Jacob Resnick has more from Istanbul.
It was a bloody weekend with 8 police officers killed in a Sunday roadside bomb attack blamed on the outlawed Kurdistan Workers' Party, known as the PKK. It was just another in a string of clashes that the military says has claimed 463 lives from February to the end of August. Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan has called on the judiciary to ban the largest Kurdish political party, claiming it is the political wing of the banned PKK. That would be a mistake, warns analyst Hugh Pope of the International Crisis Group.
Our recommendation to the government is not to fall into the trap. It must concentrate on finishing off the democratic opening that it started with so much hope. That's the way forward. Solve the Kurdish problem, then deal with the PKK.
The U.S., EU, and Turkey list the PKK as a terrorist organization. The conflict, chiefly over Kurdish language rights and political autonomy in Turkey's southeast, has killed around 40,000 people since 1984. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Istanbul.
German sportswear giant Adidas and its subsidiary, Reebok, came under attack in India today over new business practices. Hundreds of franchise owners and workers demonstrated in New Delhi. Bismila Gilani reports.
The protesters set fire to a pile of Reebok products and shouted slogans against Reebok and its Germany-based parent company, Adidas. Reebok stores across North India closed in solidarity. They say the company's new business model is not viable and poses a serious threat to their livelihood. Under the new plan, franchise holders would no longer be guaranteed a minimum income, but would instead be offered stock at what Adidas calls a reasonable discount. Rakesh Tyagi works at a Reebok store in New Delhi.
This simply means that the franchise partners close down their stores and people like us who earn a living from these stores starve. This is just plain fraud.
Nearly 900 Reebok stores in India could face closure if the company's new business policy comes into effect as scheduled in December. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
A Gaza court convicted and sentenced four men for last year's murder of an Italian peace activist. Rami Al-Maghari has more.
The Gaza City court convicted four men for the murder of International Solidarity Movement activist Vittorio Arrigoni. Mahmoud Salfiti and Tamir Hassasna were sentenced to life imprisonment plus 10 years for kidnap and murder. The other two were sentenced for lesser charges. All are believed to be Salafi Islamists. Arrigoni was kidnapped in April 2011. His captors demanded Hamas release a group of jihadist prisoners in exchange for his freedom, but he was killed before the deadline. His body was transferred to Italy, where he was laid to rest. Rami Al-Maghari, Afasaran, Gaza.
NATO has admitted killing eight women and girls who were collecting firewood before sunrise in Afghanistan yesterday. Relatives delivered their bodies to the governor's office. Seven other females injured in the airstrike, one as young as 10, were admitted to the hospital. Brigadier General Gunter Katz.
The International Security Assistance Force extends its deepest regrets and sympathies to the families and loved ones of civilians who died or were injured during a coalition airstrike on 16th of September in Lahman province.
Hours earlier, NATO had denied that any civilians were killed, saying 45 armed insurgents died in a precision attack. The LA Times reports that over two decades, the Boy Scouts of America did not report thousands of allegations of child sexual abuse to authorities. Further, their examination of 1,600 files revealed that in many cases, parents were not notified and Boy Scout officials helped the accused avoid charges. The documents, known as the perversion files, were collected by the Boy Scouts in a failed attempt to blackball alleged abusers from re-entering the group. But in many cases, the men named in the files found their way back into the youth development group to abuse again. For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
And thank you to Free Speech Radio News for those international headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found on their website, FSRN.org. And now we take a quick break. But do stay with us for more international news brought to you by Democracy Now!
Jazz is a word that means many different things to many different people. The best definition of jazz that I know of is the jazz show on CITR with yours truly, Gavin Walker. Monday nights, 9 to midnight, with the jazz feature at 11 o'clock. Check us out every Monday.
Welcome back to U News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM or online at CITR.ca. For more international news, we now go to Democracy Now!
Goodman.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. Violent protests continue in the Middle East over an American-made film considered blasphemous to Islam. Earlier today, hundreds of Yemeni protesters stormed the U.S. Embassy in Sana'a. The protesters smashed windows of the security offices outside the embassy and burned cars before breaking through the main gate of the heavily fortified compound. Some demonstrators scaled the walls of the embassy while others set fires just outside the compound. Meanwhile, at least 16 demonstrators were injured earlier today outside the U.S. Embassy in Cairo. Police reportedly used tear gas to disperse the protesters after they threw stones and petrol bombs near the embassy. The protests in Yemen and Egypt follow Tuesday night's storming of the United States consulate in the Libyan city of Benghazi. U.S. Ambassador Christopher Stevens and three other staff members were killed in the attack. Stevens is the first U.S. ambassador to be killed on duty since 1979. On Wednesday, President Obama vowed to bring to justice those responsible for the deaths in Libya.
The United States condemns in the strongest terms this outrageous and shocking attack. We're working with the government of Libya to secure our diplomats. I've also directed my administration to increase our security at diplomatic posts around the world. And make no mistake, we will work with the Libyan government to bring to justice the killers who attacked our people.
The Obama administration has dispatched an elite group of Marines to the Libyan capital of Tripoli. In addition, two U.S. warships are reportedly heading toward the Libyan coast, and the U.S. has redeployed surveillance drones over Libya. Protests against the film have also occurred in other countries, including Iraq, Iran, Tunisia, and Bangladesh.
At the center of the controversy is an online trailer for a low-budget film called The Innocence of Muslims. Initial reports said the film was directed by an Israeli real estate developer living in California named Sam Basile, but questions have arisen over whether such a person even exists. One person known to be directly involved in the film is a Coptic Christian living in California named Nakula Baseli Nakula. We're going to begin today's show in Yemen with Iona Craig, a journalist with the Times of London based in the capital of Yemen, Sana'a. Can you tell us, Iona, what is happening outside the U.S. Embassy in Sana'a right now?
The situation now is relatively calm compared to what it was a few hours ago. Earlier this morning, protesters marched on the U.S. Embassy from three different directions and reached the approach road to the U.S. Embassy building itself. They then managed to breach the cordons that had been set up on the street and managed to get inside the U.S. sort of compound itself. Burning two SUV vehicles and burning a U.S. flag. When I was there, there were then shots being fired by the Yemeni security forces in an attempt to push the crowd back and disperse them. But they were gathering again and burning tires and still chanting outside the U.S. Embassy building.
Well, the press reports here, though, say that the demonstrators were eventually rebuffed or expelled from the embassy grounds.
Yes, that's correct. As I say, there's kind of three approach roads up to the embassy building, and they were being pushed back beyond the sort of concrete blocks they're using as roadblocks in order to secure the area around the embassy building itself. But I have to say, when I was there, I witnessed protesters again trying to breach that cordon, and at one point the Yemeni soldiers just let them through, and as they marched closer to the U.S. Embassy building itself, the soldiers were actually just walking alongside them and letting them go before then eventually turning around and opening fire over the heads of the demonstrators.
Iona Craig, can you tell us what is the complaint of these protesters? Is this film that was supposedly made in California, is this the root of these protests?
This is what they all told me. All the people I spoke to today, and certainly the chanting that was going on, was all related to this film. They saw it as an insult against Prophet Muhammad, as blasphemy. They were calling for the death of the filmmaker. And they said they would not leave until the Americans left, with what they were chanting, and that they wanted to see the U.S. Embassy closed as a result of this. I have to say, amongst the people I spoke to, I didn't actually find anybody that had seen the clips of this film that had been posted on YouTube, but they'd all certainly heard about it, and this has almost appeared to be a knock-on effect from what we've seen in Libya and in Egypt as well.
There was a drone attack that supposedly killed the number two man in Al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula. The Yemeni government took credit for this attack. We have seen in WikiLeaks documents over time that the Yemeni government does take credit for U.S. drone strikes. So it's not clear exactly what happened. Was the issue of the drone attack raised as well?
Of all the people that I asked, there was no relationship between that. Nobody mentioned the issue of drones. Nobody mentioned either supposed killing of AQAP's number two, who, by the way, isn't confirmed yet. It's not 100%. Or even an attack.